So the main bulk of the retreat is actually four classes that will serve in the future as one of what we're calling middleway courses from the middleway centers, which includes the Mahasukha Center in Los Angeles. It will function as a sort of a self-contained course. You know, here it's integrated into a larger whole, into the retreat as a whole. But in the future, this could serve these four classes that I'll be doing over the next four sessions will serve as a self-contained course on what's called dependent origination. Dependent origination. That's a mouthful, and you know, I'm doing my best to try to find a better term for that. I'm not yet succeeded. There's other possibilities that are as bad. You can call it codependent arising, or dependent co-origination, or dependent origination, or, you know, but that's about the usual suspects on the translation of the original Sanskrit term. What it means is that everything exists interdependently and nothing exists independently. That's what it really means. Everything exists interdependently. That means that we, for example, exist interdependently. I am because you are. You are because I am. We exist interdependently. I can sit up here and be a teacher because you're there being a student. If you weren't there being a student, I could not be a teacher. Right? Yeah. And that's the way it goes. That's the way it goes throughout. Every aspect, every facet of life exists interdependently, not independently. And then you can say, all you Buddha heads in here, and therefore things are empty. Things are empty. Shunya, shunyata, emptiness. And then people hear emptiness and they go off into this like fog. And they say, oh, I think I understand what emptiness means. It's like, oh, it's black, I think. It's black. I can't see anything. I think I'm in emptiness maybe. And that's not what emptiness means. Here's what emptiness means. Emptiness means that things exist interdependently and are empty of existing in any other way than that. And that's all you need to know about emptiness. That's all that Nagarjuna teaches about emptiness. That's all he teaches in a chapter that is not in your reading. Everyone get reading, by the way? Yes? In a chapter that's not in your reading, this the 21st, fourth chapter, verse 18, he says, Nagarjuna, this is Nagarjuna, okay? Those of you who don't know Nagarjuna, Nagarjuna is the greatest Buddhist philosopher that ever lived. I mean, period. Sometimes called the second Buddha. I mean, he makes it regularly into the canon of world philosophers, you know. Great, unbelievably great mind. And is the go-to guy for all subsequent understandings of emptiness in all the major Buddhist traditions. Chinese tradition, Southeast Asian tradition, to the extent that they're interested in emptiness rather than just no self. Tibetan tradition, for sure. In all its sects, it's Nagarjuna that everyone goes back to when they're trying to figure out what emptiness means. So, you know, he wrote a text that I've taken one chapter from for this course called the root verses on the middle way. Root verses on the middle way. 27 chapters, I believe, of just like mind-blowing stuff, you know, just, you know, tear your brain apart, kind of like leaking out from your ears when it's over. It's just like, ugh. And so, you know, it's important to kind of study all that to make sure that the mind is blown. But if you want just the bottom line on what he teaches, I think it's summarized very nicely here in the 24th chapter, verse 18. Whatever arises dependently, whatever exists interdependently with something else, whatever arises dependently is what's called emptiness. That's it. That's emptiness. That's all you need to know about emptiness. Emptiness means that things do not exist independently. They only exist interdependently. So you can sit around and like study the rest of the 27 chapters and the verses on Nagarjuna's understanding of emptiness, but that's basically what he's saying. That things do not exist in any other way than interdependently. And that includes us. That includes each individual. We don't exist independently. Do we think we exist independently? And there's the rub. That's what's causing us problems, is that we don't get it. We don't get reality. We don't get the way things do exist. So it's not that, it's not that we don't know something. It's not that we don't know. It's that we think we know, but it's absolutely wrong. We think that we're independent. You know, at some level, each and every one of us thinks, I'm my own island. You know, nobody knows what's going on in here, right? Yeah, I'm alone in here, all by myself in here. And there's a me in here that then interacts with you. There's a me that interacts with the world, you see? Self-contained little me inside here that then, kind of like comes out and plays once in a while with the other kids and with the world. And that is a complete illusion, a complete illusion, for reasons that I'll explain in a minute. But that grasping to an independently existing me, to an independently existing basketball court, to an independently existing annoying person, is an illusion, and it causes us to suffer. So in this course, we're going to go through like how things do exist. The causal connections between things, the interdependence between things, and that's how things exist. So it's kind of nice. Instead of doing it the opposite way, instead of doing it the negative way, which is mostly what he does in this text, you know, he mostly says things are empty, and here's why they're empty. Now he's saying, here's how things do exist. And then he says, not in this chapter, but in an earlier chapter. And there are the two ways of talking about exactly the same thing. Two ways of talking about exactly the same thing. Things exist interdependently and are empty of existing in any other way than interdependently. So you can talk about it positively or you can talk about it negatively, but you're talking about the same thing. Things are empty of existing independently. For all you like negative folks, I like negation. Okay? Things do not exist independently. They are empty of existing independently. But they do exist interdependently. And those are two ways of talking about the same thing. You can talk about the plenitude or you can talk about the emptiness. You see? And then people get like, I've had people in my classes argue with me about this. You know, we'll teach Nagarjuna and things are empty. No, they're not. They're full. It's just two ways of talking about the same thing. You can talk about the one, the cosmic one, or you can talk about the absence, the void. Two ways of talking about the same thing. One positively, one negative. And then people have big fights over this. They have wars over this, probably. You say potato and I say potato. Let's have a big war. Tomato and tomato, Emptiness or plenitude? Same thing. Things are empty of existing independently. But things exist interdependently. And they're empty of existing in any other way than that. And that's the ballgame right there. That's all you need to know about like fancy-dancy philosophy, actually. Now, that knowing that intellectually is one thing, kind of understanding what I just said in the words and all like that, but realizing it's a whole other kettle, whole fish. Realizing it. Realizing that you are not independent, that there is no independent you, that we are all in a nexus, and we're not even nodes in the nexus. See, a node in the nexus would be an independent existing node that then entered into, relationships with other nodes. It's just relationship. It's just interdependence. No nodes, just network. Okay? No nodes, just network. And realizing that would be a major achievement, you see? We would become a different kind of being. We would live differently. We would feel differently. We would be differently. We would be some awakened person. We would be a realized person if we realized that. So, you know, getting it intellectually, and we'll go through the text and try to get it intellectually. But the realization is what matters. That's what really matters. So this is a text. This is a text on the 12, what they call the 12 links, the 12 links of dependent origination, and those links are depicted like this often. Everyone get one of these in their hand up. How come nobody's looking at anything? Just at me. Did you get this?
Oh no, it's upstairs.
It's upstairs?
Yeah, I have it upstairs. You want me to look at it?
Yes, please. So I'll wait and talk about that later, so you can look at it. So I'll talk a little bit about the 12 links so that you'll get confused right away. 12 links sounds so linear, doesn't it? There's link 1, and then there's link 2, and there's link 3. And it is presented that way because I'm not sure you could present it any other way in words. You have to, you know, you have to speak sequentially, right? You have to say that, you know, this comes after that. But this is a wheel. This is a circle, not a line. The 12 is not first, second, third, fourth, sixth, like that. It's presented that way, and we'll go through it that way. But it's important to know from the very start that the 12 links of interdependence are interdependent. Each link depends on the other. So in that sense, it's a circle rather than a line, right? And we'll look at the different understandings of those 12 links, including that one. There's one understanding that does kind of go linearly. There's another understanding of the 12 links that goes linearly through three lifetimes. It takes three lifetimes to get through all the three links. And there's another one that just messes it all up and says, you know, you got to start with link 7 and then go back to 4 and back to 3. And in order to try to explain how they all are necessary for each other. They are all necessary for each other. And then that's one way to complicate it. Then the other thing that's really important is the weak links. Because this is the circle of suffering that you're now going to get depictions of. So you can look too. This is a circle of suffering. And the whole point of a spiritual life is to break out of the circle, to get off the gerbil wheel of continual suffering, self-perpetuating suffering. Can you see it, Clark? You're looking like you can't see nothing. Is it your contact lenses?
I think it's my contact lenses. Either that or I'm getting old.
Yeah. So please read the Tibetan at the bottom there, Claire.
I only read Wiley.
All right, so if you have a look, I'll just go through this quickly. This is the visual depiction of it. And do we have the Cindy's pictures of it also? Okay, good. So they're coming too. Might as well give everyone everything. And we'll go through the 12 as we get to them and refresh your memory of how they're depicted. I'll just talk a little bit about the whole visual here that you're looking at. You see that it's a big circle, right? It's a big circle, and it's being held by a monster, being held inside the jaws of a monster. Everyone see the monster? That's death. That's the Lord of Death. And that's scary. It's supposed to be scary, okay? It's pretty scary, isn't it? He's got, like, fiery eyebrows, at least. And so this is not... You know, this is not some beautiful, you know, painting of something really pleasant. This is problem. This is the big problem here, cosmic problem. And so you got this big monster of death there. Then look on the top right-hand side. Who's that? Who's that dude up there? That would be the Buddha. And notice that the Buddha is not in the circle. That's why he's the Buddha. Because he's off the gerbil wheel of suffering, outside the circle. And he's pointing to the moon. He's pointing to the moon. This is a very famous expression in spiritual circles, that all of these instructions, including this one on dependent origination, is just fingers pointing to the moon, pointing to the truth, pointing to the truth that cannot be put into words, that cannot be argued, that cannot be put into doctrines and dogmas and orthodoxies. And Buddha's just saying, I'll try to point you there. I'll try to take you there. Remember that old song? I know a place. Ain't nobody crying. Ain't no suffering. Nobody worried. You see? And that's the moon. I'll take you there. He can't actually take us there. He can just point us to the moon that we have to take ourselves to. Okay? So that's his function up there, saying, look, there's a whole different thing, except, other than this wheel inside the jaws of death. Whole different experience. So then in the outside ring of the wheel are what they call these are the depictions of the 12 links. You see the beginning on about 12:05, 12 o'clock, 5 minutes after 12, there's a blind man walking with a cane. Can you see it? Yeah. And that's the first link. That's ignorance. And that one and the next one, the potter there, that's what's called karmic propensities. And then the next one over is we're going clockwise, right? The next one's the monkey, that's consciousness. And the fourth one is what's called name and form. Those are the guys in the boat there. Those are the four we'll do tonight. And I'll come back to them. So then, by the time we're done at the fourth class, we'll go through all 12. Then on the next level in, there are six sort of segments there, six pies, part of the pies. Those represent the six traditional cosmological possibilities of existence. The top ones are better. The bottom ones are worse. They're all inside the circle. So none of them are the moon. If you look on the left top part, first one to the left, above the dividing line, that's the human realm. You are there, like in the shopping malls. You are here, right there. You can put a little dot right there. I am here. And that's one possibility of where you could be, according to the ancient cosmology. Then to the far right is what they call the demigods, the asuras. The demigods have got it pretty good. They're called, demigods. I mean, but demi means not quite, sort of godlike. And they've got a pretty cushy life, but their suffering comes from the fact that they know somebody else has got a cushier life. So they look over to the top middle, at the very top there, that's the god realm. And if you look, you can see that the demigods are fighting with the gods. They're always fighting because the demigods want what the gods got. It's like, most everyone's from L.A., right? It's like if you lived in Pacific Palisades and looked over and saw Malibu and said, damn nice here in Pacific Palisades, but Malibu. I'd really like a place in Malibu. And then they get all, get their knickers in a twist about that they're not in Malibu. And then the gods are up there in the top. God realm is pretty good. God realm, here's what the God realm's sort of like. The God realm is like when it's cold, you have heat. When it's hot, you have fans or air conditioning. When you want something, you can just buy it, When you want to get somewhere, you can just get into a car or an airplane or a train or whatever and just go there, quickly. It's just kind of cushy there. It's designer samsara. Okay? It's the bubble. It's the bubble version of this suffering life. Until it's not. So the mythology of this realm is that they go through long periods of time where just everything's fine. And there's absolutely no motivation to come to some damn retreat in the middle of nowhere and study, you know, spirituality. You know why? Weather is good, surfs up, you know. Lots of things on TV. 170,000 channels on the cable, you know. Why bother? You know, got plenty of money, got plenty of food, got every kind of ethnic restaurant I know of. See, no ethnicity, not represented. You know? And yes, why bother? Everything's fine. But then, you know, the God realm, their particular suffering all comes at the end. All of these are suffering realms. All of these have their own particular suffering. Their suffering all comes at the end, where, you know, they've gone through the, you know, the karma of having a life like that, of having a cushy life like jet fuel, with no motivation to do anything to other than just enjoy, other than just consume. And so then at the end, it all comes down. And the very, very sort of graphic, interesting, you know, parts of that mythology, that their necklaces, their garlands that they wear around their neck, because it's very nice to have garlands around your neck. You know, it's like being in Hawaii with the, what do you call those things that they give you off the plane? Lei, you get your lei, and you smell your lei all day. When the karma starts running out, their garlands wilt. They start to wilt for the first time. And they start to get body odor. You know, they start stinking. And, you know, so all of a sudden, like, all of their, you know, the beauty and the, you know, the wonderfulness of their lives start to crumble. And then all the other gods don't want to hang out with them because they're stinky. They've got wilted garlands, you know. So they all kind of, like, are shunned. And here's the worst part, okay? The worst part is they say, yeah, this is mythology, but it's very kind of poignant. At the end, they say they get a glimpse as to what comes next after they die, you see, after they end their tenure there in the God realm. They get a glimpse of where they go, and it's way down. It's like getting a, it's like for us, if we were on our deathbed, to get a glimpse of our next life living in a cardboard box on the streets of Mumbai, starving, you know, watching our kids die of preventable diseases. Get a glimpse that's next. And they just totally freak out, like we would, right? If we were, like, you know, within minutes or, you know, hours of living a completely different life than the life that we. Then there's the lower births, the lower realms. The one on the far right is the animal realm. You see all those animals there? That gives it away, it being the animal realm and all. And that's regarded as a lower birth. And you know, I think many of us romanticize animals because we're not around them. Until you come out to here. Out here, you can't romanticize rattlesnakes that well. Or bears, you know. But you can romanticize kitty cats and puppy dogs and goldfish, you know. And say, like, oh, they're so cute and they have such fun in life. See, that's the top of the line when it comes to animal life. Your Fifi or, you know, pussycat, you know, they got the best deal of all possible deals when it comes to animal life. Okay, they get the little sweaters, you know, and the expensive, you know, food, and all of that. The rest of the animals, you know, don't live like that. Even Fifi and what's the cat's name? Fifi is the cat's name, and puppy dog Bow Wow, Fido, Fifi and Fido. Even Fifi and Fido, who got the, you know, the coats and everything, they still have deep dullness in their minds. They are pretty much entirely driven by instinct. Pretty much entirely. You can sit there and talk about the 12 links of dependent and origination all day long to Fifi and Fido, and they'll just look at you. Yeah. Is it time to go outside yet? You know, where's food? could I have some food? Right? So, you know, don't romanticize. Like, and the rest, for the rest of them, for the rest of animals, there's two things that animals are thinking about pretty much all the time. What can I find to eat, and who's going to kill me? You know, constantly. Look at birds. You ever see birds? You know, constantly looking around, like just, you know, who's going to kill me? Where's there something to eat? And pretty much all animals are like that. So that's the animal realm. Then the one on the far left bottom is what they call the preta realm, the hungry ghost realm. This is a realm that you get to through great greed, you know, just wanting all the time, greed. And so they say, you know, you could get reborn in that realm where you're absolutely driven by wanting all the time and never being able to satisfy it. So the mythology goes, you know, very graphic, very colorful, you know, mythology. The mythology sort of usually depicts them as having very, very small mouths, very, very skinny necks, and great big stomachs. And they're just driven by their appetites. And as soon as they find some food or water, the food turns into, you know, shit. And the water turns into pus and blood. And they can't get it down anyway. You know, it's like that. Never satisfied. Cannot satisfy. And constantly being driven by their greed. So, sound familiar? I think we have versions of every one of these realms in human life. You know, some people experience those realms even here and now. Then the bottom one is the full-on hell realm, and depicted here as the fiery one, the hot realm. In the Buddhist cosmology, there's two basic kinds of hell realms. And then they're divided into I don't know how many different neighborhoods, 18 or 8 each. So there's 8 hot realms and 8 cold realms. It's very interesting. It's like elemental suffering. It's either too hot or too cold. Elemental, you know, the elements are against you, and that's how that. So this one's one of the hot ones, but there are they say there are cold ones too. So then we go inside. One more thing. I actually have to go inside too because I'm not really sure what that one with 6 figures is. But I'll tell you what the one with 3 is because that's really important. You see the snake there? The snake. Then there's a rooster usually or a pigeon sometimes they say, and a pig. And you'll notice that it's from the pig's mouth that both the snake and the rooster are coming from. Everyone see it okay? It's getting kind of close now, right? The pig is actually an intelligent animal, you know? Pigs are actually quite intelligent and make quite good pets, apparently. I've known people who've had pigs as pets. And you can train them to do all kinds of stuff, and they're very smart. But they roll around in filth. And they'll eat even their own feces. You see, they're dirty. And it's kind of an interesting image to pick for ignorance. You can be very, very clever. You can know a lot of tricks. But you're rolling around in filth. That's the symbol for ignorance. And that's the main problem in the wheel. That's what keeps the wheel going, mainly. Is that one and another one we'll talk about later. Ignorance is number one in the links. And that's represented by that pig there. Then the rooster or the pigeon is desire, is always wanting something you don't have. And it's out of ignorance, see, it's coming out of the mouth. But the two things that are coming out of the mouth of the pig are two main problems that stem from ignorance. So these are what they call the 3 root mental afflictions, the 3 root problems that cause us all our trouble. Ignorance is the root of the root. Ignorance is root squared. But from ignorance comes, I always want more than I have. desire, kama, raga in Sanskrit. And then the snake, I don't want what I have. Aversion. Sometimes they call them greed and aversion. Different kind of translations for these. But basically, these are three forms of discontentment. Three forms of discontentment. Right? The rooster, I want something I don't have. I'm discontent with what I have. I want something more. The snake, I'm discontent with what I do have. And I want to get rid of it. See? If only I didn't have this, like, irritating person in my life. Then I'd be happy. If only I didn't have this crappy car and I got a new SUV, then I'd be happy. And then ignorance. Ignorance is a form of discontentment too, for the reasons I mentioned earlier. I don't know if you caught it. Ignorance is not accepting it's like this now. Ignorance is saying it should be different than it is now. And that's ignorance. Because guess what? It isn't different than it is now. Because it's like this. Not, it's different, should be different than it is now. So that's just ignorance. Ignorance about reality. Ignorance about the way things are. The way things are is like this now. And thinking, no, it shouldn't be like that, is ignorance. See what I mean? Yeah. That's one way of talking about ignorance. Ignorance has many, many facets. Let me count the ways that we are ignorant. And we'll count some ways. All right, so that's the depiction here. There's a tradition, actually, in Tibetan Buddhism of putting this up somewhere near your door, front door or back door, putting it like right above the door or something like that, so that you look at it every time you come in or go out the door. And you remind yourself, oh, this is where I am, you see. And this is why I'm where I am, you see. So you remember. A lot of the spiritual life is about remembering. It's a really important virtue to try to remember what you already know. Chances are pretty good that you're not going to learn radically new things this weekend. You'll learn some new things. But chances are you're probably not going to hear for the first time that you shouldn't be greedy all the time. Or that, you know, that you shouldn't always, like, have this aversion about, you know, things that are actually part of your life, you know. You should have a little more acceptance, and probably not the first time you've heard stuff like that. We might even talk about forgiveness once in a while. I don't know. We'll see. And it's like, oh, I just went to a retreat where they told me I should forgive. You know, it's not like light bulbs will go off on top of your head going, ooh, forgiveness, there's a concept. There's a new idea. You know what I mean? We've heard all these things many, many times before. But we don't remember. We forget, especially under the spell of the mental afflictions. Especially under the haze that sets in on our minds when we're angry, when we're upset, when we're jealous, when we're envious, when we're proud, when we want something really, really badly. See, then it all just goes out the window, doesn't it? Yeah. Went out the window for me briefly this morning when the shower didn't work. I wanted to take a shower. And the shower wasn't working properly. And, you know, I was tired and it'd been a long couple of weeks and all like that. And, you know, you just lose it. And then it's like, you wake up 5-10 minutes later and you go, oh my God, you know, what an idiot. I'm having this conniption fit about a damn shower, you know. But when you're in the conniption fit, it all seems quite reasonable, doesn't it? It just seems like the logical thing to do to start swearing at people about your shower. All mental afflictions are like that. All mental afflictions are ridiculous. They are all ridiculous. They are all completely illogical. And it's partly just getting a little bit of wisdom to recognize that. Instead of defending them, instead of rationalizing them, saying, no, no, that shower deserved it. Which we do. I mean, you know, you don't hold grudges too long against inanimate objects. You know, you kind of recognize your own stupidity pretty quickly when you start getting angry at showers. But when there's somebody else around that you can get angry at about the shower, you can maintain that one for a little bit longer. Can't you? like it's somebody else's fault that the shower didn't work. So it's important to have practice confession. So let's look at the text. This is the 26th chapter, and it's very interesting. It follows the 25th chapter, which is not the interesting part. The 26th chapter you would expect to follow the 25th chapter. But 25 chapters on, you know, how everything is empty. Everything is empty. And he ends the 25th chapter with a very powerful statement, which I'll just read you. So I'm, you know, set up the context a little bit for this chapter. Peace, you know, shanti. Peace is the pacification of all perception and all conceptualization. No dharma whatsoever was ever taught by the Buddha. And you go, what? No dharma? Dharma means, you know, truth. Dharma means, you know, spiritual truth. And Nagarjuna ends, the last thing he says before he gets to this chapter is, the Buddha didn't teach any dharma at all. Yeah, it's puzzling. It's a little puzzling, so we have to, like, kind of unpack it a little bit. There's a number of different ways that you can understand that. The Buddha didn't teach any dharma that wasn't contingent at all, that wasn't adaptable to different circumstances. No absolute dharma, okay? So you could say the Buddha didn't teach any orthodoxy at all. And Nagarjuna makes that point several times in several different ways in this text. The Buddha didn't teach any dharma that wasn't just a tool, more or less useful. Like a raft, that's a very, you know, there's a whole sutra where the Buddha says, everything I say, all my teachings, it's just like a raft. You get on a raft in order to cross the lake. You got a lake here. But when you get to the other side, you don't carry around your raft going, yeah, I kept my sacred raft, my holy sacred raft. You're on the other side of the lake. You don't need the raft anymore. Just utility, you see. It's just more or less useful for the time being to get you where you need to go. But once you've got there, then, you know, you don't cling on to the raft. So that's another way of understanding. Here's a deeper way of understanding. The Buddha taught no dharma at all. The Buddha taught no truth, no absolute truth, because the absolute truth cannot be taught at all, cannot be put into words. The Tao that can be named, the Tao that can be talked about, Tao Te Ching, right? It's not the true Tao. The truth that can be put into words, that can be put into doctrines, is not the true truth. True truth, the ultimate truth, the real truth. It's just an approximation. It's just fingers pointing to the moon. See, and then people go, oh, you know, my finger's better than your finger. My finger's pointing more accurately than your finger. Yeah, pointing the same way. You know. And then they have big finger wars. You know. No, you say Tao and we say Brahman. And you say Atman and we say Anatman. We say emptiness, you say plenitude, you know. Just fingers, just pointing to the same moon. That cannot be named. That cannot be talked about. So many of you heard my joke. Some of you are new, so I'll tell you. I get to tell the same jokes again. Religion, spirituality is like a swimming pool. All the noise is coming from the shallow end. The deep end, everyone's quiet. You don't have big wars between mystics. You know, you don't have the organized Taoist mystics, you know, squaring off against the Hindu mystics. You know. It's the shallow end people who are all like fighting and disputing and, you know, debating, you know. That's for the children. That's for the spiritual children. So the Buddha taught no dharma whatsoever in that sense. He couldn't teach the absolute truth. Only taught the provisional truth. Only taught the contingent truth. And it's useful. It's helpful. So that's how it ends. And then what happens? After he just says, the most radical statement probably, and one of the most radical statements in the whole text, then what's the next chapter? the thing that the Buddha taught. The main thing that the Buddha taught, dependent origination. He morphs right into it. Very kind of interesting. Some scholars have argued that this chapter is an add-on. That actually the original text ended with that statement that I just talked about. Which is kind of cool. I mean, it's kind of cool to think that that's how it originally ended. And then people said, no, you can't end it like that. It's too, you know, too rad. You know, better put on some stuff for the, you know, so that people will, like, you know, won't lose faith or something, right? But it's, you know, nobody knows. Nobody knows where the text actually ends. The text that we have today has these chapters, and the earliest commentaries had these chapters also. Chandrakirti and others had these chapters too. So this is the received text, with chapter 26 following chapter 25 and that radical end to chapter 25. Obstructed by ignorance, one creates the threefold karmic predispositions that lead to rebirth. Because of these karmic acts, he or she takes rebirth. So we just got link one and link two in that verse. Link one and link two. So these are my translations from the original Sanskrit, and then all of that stuff in italics that you have in your text, that's a commentary. That's my commentary. So, you know, I'll comment on it orally, but you'll have this to refer to go back and study a little bit. So I just told you about how he ended the last chapter, and then here he comes on one of the main things that the Buddha was supposedly taught. The Buddha didn't teach any Dharma whatsoever. Now, here's the Dharma that the Buddha taught. Kind of basically like that. This is a doctrine that's accepted by all Buddhist schools. All Buddhist schools accept the doctrine of the 12 links of dependent origination. It's one of the universals in all forms of Buddhism. So the causal chain, which in the forward direction ensnares us in samsara, and the reversal of which liberates us into nirvana. By the way, that chapter 25, which ended in that sort of radical way, is nirvana. It's called nirvana, the analysis of nirvana, and how nirvana is empty, basically. And so he follows that up with the teaching on how to end samsara and enter nirvana, actually. The 12 links of dependent origination. If you follow them forward, they keep you in samsara. If you undo them, you know, going backward, you end up in nirvana. So that's one way of understanding the relationship between those 12 links. Since we now so thoroughly understand the emptiness side of things, right, kids? Having studied it for 25 chapters, we can at last consider the other side of the coin. Everything is empty, very much including the process of dependent origination. This is not exempt. You know, this scheme is not exempt from the deconstructionist enterprise of emptiness. And partly because it's kind of obvious why it's not exempt. Each link depends on the others. No link exists independently. So the chain of dependent origination is itself what? Dependent. And not independent. And no part of it is independent. So yeah. Things do exist as dependently originating phenomena. Emptiness and dependent origination are two ways of talking about the same thing, as been said in this quote I already mentioned. Whatever arises dependently is what's called emptiness. Now, there are at least three different understandings of what it means to say that things exist dependently. So we'll go through those quickly. Things exist dependently on their causes and conditions. Nothing exists independently of its causes or conditions, right? Everything is in the nexus of causality. And that's primarily the understanding of dependence that Nagarjuna works with in this chapter, actually. Explicitly. Then, everything exists dependently on its parts. And that one's a little trickier. Understanding that things exist dependently on their causes is pretty understandable, right? It's the assumption of science in a way, right? That everything is in, you know, you can figure out the causes of things, right? There's a cause to these glasses. It was, you know, they were manufactured in some factory, then they were sold to some warehouse, some wholesaler, and then they got to some retailer, and then I bought them. You know, that there were causes that brought me these glasses, right? But these glasses also exist dependently on the parts. So, is this one thing or many things?
Yes.
Yeah. How can it be both? It's either one or many. Those are different concepts, aren't they? Single and multiple. Right? Aren't those different concepts? How could it be both? Which is it? One or many?
One.
Is it one? How many pairs of glasses am I holding?
One.
So there's one. It's one glasses, I guess.
One pair.
Oh, so it's a pair. So it's at least two. Yeah, right? Even in our language, we're like sort of like unclear on whether it's one thing or many. Yeah, it's a pair of glasses. No, I mean, you know, how could I be holding more than one piece, one glass? If, you know, it has to be one, right? Right? How could I wear one, you know, if it were like 45 glasses, how could I put them on my face? Huh? So it's one, right? But does it have parts?
Yes.
How many parts? A bunch. A whole bunch, you could say, technically speaking, whole bunch of parts. So how many things are there? It's got like bow parts, it's got, you know, lens parts, it's got frame parts. It's got these ear comforter parts. It's got these nostril sort of shaped parts, bridge of the nose parts. How many parts does it have? How many parts does just this part have? This is the one bow part. How many parts?
Many.
Yeah, I mean, how long you want to count, right? It's got the top part, the middle part, and the bottom part, let's say, okay? Top part, middle part, bottom part. How many parts does the top part have? It's got a top part, a middle part, and a bottom part, doesn't it? The top part has a top part, a middle part, and a bottom part. How many parts does the top of the top part have? Top of the top of the top part, middle of the top of the top part, bottom of the top of the top part. Right? And down you go, and there's no end to that. So how many things am I holding? Yeah, potentially you could say infinite number of things. So which is it, one or many? One or many?
Many.
Things depend, the glasses depend on its parts, right? Glasses depend on its parts. There wouldn't be glasses unless there were parts of glasses, right? The glasses are composed of parts, right? The glasses depend on their parts, don't they? But the parts of the glasses depend on the glasses, too. There wouldn't be this part of glasses unless there was glasses for this part to be a part of. And that's interdependence. The whole depends on the parts, but the parts depend on the whole. And that's the only way that they actually can exist as both one thing and many things. They do exist as one thing and many things because of the interdependence between wholes and parts. Then the third level of interdependence, the third and most profound level, is that things exist dependently on our conceptualizing them the way we do. So I can conceptualize causality. The only causality that there is a conceptualization of causality. There isn't causality happening out there. That's impossible, and here's why. If it were happening out there, it should be apparent which came first, the cause or the effect. Let's say that the cause of a sprout is a seed. Is that right? Cause of a sprout is a seed. So which comes first, the cause or the effect? Well, the effect can't come first, right? You can't have... The sprout can't just be there because it wouldn't need the seed then. I'm a sprout already. What do I need you for, seed? See, not dependent on the seed. If the result came first, right, it wouldn't be dependent on the cause. But the cause isn't a cause until the result occurs. The seed isn't the cause of a sprout until and unless there's a sprout, isn't it? The seed is sitting there all by itself. Can't be a cause of anything until the result occurs. Yeah? Do all seeds bring about sprouts? Yeah, you know, some seeds don't sprout at all. So a seed can't be the cause of a sprout. Right? So which comes first? The cause or the effect? And you can say yes. Because it's overlaid. It's a perception. We perceive, we overlay, we conceptualize causality, and that's the only way causality can possibly exist. Retroactively. When there's a result, we can say there must have been a cause. And then we overlay cause and effect on top of it. What about the parts in the whole? Can there be parts of the glasses without the whole? So you have to have a conceptualization of the whole for there to be parts of the whole, don't you? Where's the whole coming from? H-W-H, not H-O. Where's the whole? Where's the unity coming from of these glasses? Multiple parts. Multiple parts all of a sudden form a unity, is that right? Then it would be one thing. Then it would be one. It wouldn't be multiple parts. It would just be one thing. Who puts the multiple parts together as a whole? You do. We do. Of course, we overlay a concept, overlay a conceptualization on the multiple parts, and we say it's a whole. But the parts of the whole couldn't exist without the whole either. If there wasn't a conceptualization of these things as glasses, you couldn't say part. This is a part of glasses. You see, until and unless we have the concept of glasses, there can't be parts of glasses. And of course, there can't be glasses unless there's parts of glasses. So which one comes first? Neither one can come first. They exist interdependently, right? The parts of the glasses and the glasses exist interdependently, and that relationship of interdependence is overlaid by the perceiver. Isn't it? Yeah. So now we're getting there. Start. Anybody leaking at all? You could just use your handkerchief and, you know, gently, like, brush it away. So what about the... So I guess that just means that everything depends on me perceiving it. I got it. Now I got it. Now I'm graduate school, Buddhism graduate school. Everything depends on the perceiver perceiving it, isn't it? So the glasses to be glasses depends on me perceiving the glasses, right? But for me to be a perceiver, I have to be perceiving something. I'm not just sitting here being, I'm a perceiver, not perceiving anything, soon I'll perceive. Okay? So the perception of things like glasses makes possible me as a perceiver. The perceiver makes possible the glasses by being perceived. But the glasses make the perceiver possible too. And that's interdependence at its highest level. That's interdependence at its highest level. And things are empty of existing in any other way than that. No perceiver without something perceived. No something perceived without a perceiver, and neither one without perception. Without perceiving, present participle. That's the emptiness of the three spheres, what they call the emptiness of the three spheres. And that's how things exist, and they are empty of existing in any other way than that. And we could all just go home now. Okay? No seer without something seen. No seer without a visible object, right? No visible object until and unless what? It's seen. It's not visible unless it's seen, right? No visible object. I'm not talking about potentially visible. Potentially means a lot of different things. Everything's potential. But for the visible object to be visible, it has to be seen, isn't it? Anyone want to argue with any of this? Is there a A visible object that wasn't being seen would be an invisible visible object. Okay? No visible object until and unless it's seen. And no seer as a seer until and unless what? Seeing something. Got to see something to be a seer. Can't be a seer all by yourself. See, nothing exists independently. Got to be a seer. You are a seer by seeing something. And the something seen is visible because it's being seen. And neither one, visible object or seer, can exist without the seeing, the link between the two. And you just run it through all the senses. All five physical senses. Nothing heard, nothing audible until and unless it's heard. Right? What would it mean to say there's a sound that no one hears? See? Impossible, right? A sound becomes a sound, becomes an audible sound when it's heard, and not until. And there's no hearer until and unless what? They hear something. Got to hear something to be a hearer. And there's no hearer and there's no audible sound unless there is hearing. Some relationship between it. And the same is true with all the five senses. Now, what about the mind? Is there a thinker who exists independently as a thinker who isn't thinking something? I'm a thinker, but I have no thought. Right? I mean, right? The thinker becomes a thinker when they think. You see? And the thought doesn't sit around going, I hope somebody's going to think me someday. Right? I'm this awesome thought. I wish I could be thunk. The thought becomes a thought when it's thunk by a thinker. And there's no thinker without a thought that's thunk, and there's no thought without a thinker that's thinking it. Okay? So that's a very important part of this whole scheme. There's no projector. You know, sometimes we hear like, oh, I'm projecting my reality or something like that. That would be an independently existing projector who's just sitting around going, I think I'll project some reality. Boom. See? That's impossible. That is not interdependence, to think that I'm projecting my reality. I am in the nexus of interdependence. There cannot be a projector unless there's a projection. And there's no projection without a projector. And then when you try to find the projector of the projection, the projector becomes a projection of another projector. When you're thinking about who's the projector here, you just reposition it into the object, just as this is a new object of another projector. I'm a projector of a projector. And back you go. There's no projector that isn't a projection of another projector. Yeah. Like going to the barber shop or the beauty shop where the mirrors are facing each other, and you go into infinite regress. And that's how things exist. And they are empty of existing in any other way than that. And that's a hard thing to get your head around. Everything starts with ignorance. And that's ignorance, okay? Well, anything other than what I just said is ignorance. Any kind of grasping to anything that exists independently and not interdependently is one way of talking about ignorance. And the chief villain here is you say your name to yourself. Because we think that we exist independently. Never mind about, like, glasses. Who the hell cares about glasses? Yeah, glasses exist independently. But not me. See? So when he says obstructed by ignorance, this is the root problem. The root problem is that we're ignorant. And when he's talking about ignorance, as I say in the last paragraph in the commentary, he's talking about inborn ignorance. There's two kinds of ignorance. There's learned ignorance and inborn ignorance. And we're all sentient beings, actually. All living beings are born with inborn ignorance. You know, the idea that there's me and the world, and that we're not in some kind of interdependent relationship. And worms have that same ignorance. You know, flies. There's a lot of flies here that have that ignorance. A lot of ignorance going around in flyland here. And we all have that ignorance too, from birth. And then there's learned ignorance, where we're encouraged to think that we're independent individuals, especially in our cultures. In Western cultures, we're encouraged to think we're individuals, you know. And that's good to be an individual, you see. I have somebody sent me a picture from the internet, a meme, is that what they call it? Meme? It's a photograph inside a shop, and there are two sweaters that are photographed that have both of them exactly the same color with exactly the same design. The design is a little snowflake, and it says, "I am unique." Marketed in multiple forms. And we all think that we're unique. And that we should be unique. See, that's some kind of virtue. That's some kind of goal. You're born unique. You're born, each and every one of us is born uniquely into the same ignorance. Uniquely into exactly the same mistake of thinking that we're unique. And we're all unique about thinking that we're unique. We all have uniquely our own, like, little snowflake suffering self. And then we grasp onto it going, yes, it's mine, my snowflake. See? And you know, you are a snowflake. Congratulations, you're born a snowflake. Yeah, everyone's born exactly the same way. We're all born equally as snowflakes. Unique individuals with propensities that we have, as Nagarjuna says here. We're born with our own unique little, you know, kind of karmic little snowflake. And then we spend the rest of our lives elaborating it, you know, and thinking that that's the whole point of life, is to be more unique, as if that's possible. Uniquer. And especially more unique than other people, who shouldn't be so damn unique. I should be uniquer than they. So then we have this big uniquer, you know, kind of competition of who's going to be more of a snowflake, you see? More of a uniquer snowflake. And we're all snowflakes. And we're small and melting. Yeah. And that's why we're in the jaws of death. Yeah. Small and melting. So the idea, the liberation is not to get to be the biggest snowflake. You know, to be like a mega snowflake or something, a Buddha snowflake. So that you're really, really big snowflake, individual snowflake. The purpose of the goal of liberation is to realize that you're the globe in which all snowflakes occur, in which all snowflakes are contained. You see, to be the one, not the plenitude or the emptiness, not the particular, not any of the particular. To be the ocean rather than the wave. To be an ocean rather than any particular wave. Not even Big Bertha, you see. We're all hoping, like, maybe I'll be Big Bertha when I grow up and be a really big wave. But all waves go back into the ocean, don't they? They come from the ocean and they go back to the ocean. Yeah. And that's who you really are. You're the ocean, not any particular wave. And that means that you're not a particular anything. You're not an individual, really. Deep down, you see, your true nature, your Buddha nature, your true self, you know, your soul, whatever language you want to put on it, is the ocean, not the particular wave. The particular wave is a goner. It rises, it lasts for a while, crests, and then it goes down. And then, you know, the energy of waves, like, push on a different wave, don't they? They push ahead. Yeah. And, you know, so maybe there's a rebirth, I don't know. But you go down into the ocean first, no matter what. You come from the ocean and you go down into the ocean. And that image is a very powerful image in a lot of traditions. In the tradition that I grew up in Christianity, that's exactly what baptism meant. You would go and, you know, some of you aren't familiar with the old-timey religion, but, you know, in the Baptist churches, they all have swimming pools in the back of the altar there. And they oftentimes have, like, paintings of, you know, the River Jordan and all these kinds of, like, you know, things from biblical times. And you would go, when you were baptized, you would put on, you know, your swimsuit underneath your gown. They put a robe on, you'd have your swimsuit, and the pastor would put you all the way into the water, take you all, full immersion, they called it. And out of the chaos, you see, out of the amorphousness of water, you know, water isn't something. You can't like divide up water and say this part, you see? It's all just amorphous. Emptiness. Out of the plenitude, out of the emptiness, and then you're born again. Come out again. And it's a very powerful image. Water is a very powerful image in religion. It's found a lot of different places. As a purification, see? Water is purification. Because it is amorphous. Because it isn't something. Because it is like a symbol for everything or nothing, you see? It's a symbol for everything or nothing. And we go back into the ocean. We go back into the amorphousness and then come back out, born again, new. Yeah, different wave. All right. The process starts with ignorance, here particularly meaning the innate as opposed to learned or intellectually acquired belief in self-existence. Self-existence is just another name for independence. That things exist independently, that there's a seer who exists independently of the visible object seen, and vice versa. That's what self-nature means. So belief in self-existence or self-nature, the root of all our suffering. Ignorance gives rise to one or another of the threefold karmic dispositions. You see that in 26.1 there? Obstructed by ignorance, one creates the threefold karmic predispositions. So the ignorance is represented by the blind man and also by the pig. The threefold karmic predispositions, the Sanskrit is sanskara. There's another Sanskrit word that you may know that's more or less a synonym, vasana. So out of ignorance, one creates threefold karmic predispositions. This is understood, as you'll see in the commentary there, in two different ways. Either our tendency, so predisposition means a tendency, right? A proclivity, right? Either to our tendency to act, speak, and think ignorantly, to act, speak, and think ignorantly, or to virtuous, non-virtuous, and neutral actions performed out of ignorance. So you can certainly perform virtuous actions out of ignorance. Almost all our virtuous actions are performed out of ignorance. You see? So just because it's virtuous doesn't mean it's not ignorant. Any time that you say your name to yourself or performing a virtuous action, it's ignorant. Grasping to self. Grasping to a self that doesn't exist. The snowflake self that doesn't exist for reasons I'll talk about before in a minute. So out of this ignorance, then we create karmic predispositions. We create the kind of propensities for the future. So this is represented in the Wheel of Life as a potter. A potter who's got a pot going on the wheel, who's shaping a pot. Yeah, and Cindy's got her, I don't have one. No, Lauren, you keep yours. Maybe I'll get an extra one someday. Okay. Yeah. So you see the predispositions there. The ignorance is the rock star there. It looks like a rock star who's wearing...
It's a blonde
person. It looks like an aging rock star wearing sunglasses. But it's really a blind man. And then the potter, the predispositions are the potter sort of forming a new piece of clay, new sculpture, pot. In either case, it's because of these three karmic acts that we are forced to take rebirth. So then we get to the next part of the first verse here. Obstructed by ignorance, one creates the threefold karmic predispositions that lead to rebirth. Because of these karmic acts, he or she takes rebirth. So that's verse one, and don't worry, I'm only going to do two verses tonight. So we're more than half done, because I did a lot of detours. There are four kinds of ignorance, you could say. Here's another way of talking. There's all kinds of ignorance. Let me count the ways. Okay, so we already counted one or two ways in which we're ignorant. We're ignorant in primarily, okay, this is inborn ignorance, in grasping to an independent self that does not exist. An independent, unitary, unchanging self that is a complete illusion. And I am very pleased to report that the neurosciences have come to the same conclusion. They've given up trying to find HQ. Because it isn't there. They've given up trying to find a unifying self that unifies all experience into one. They've given up trying to find an unchanging part of the brain, an unchanging you, that goes through life and all its many, many changes, moment to moment, over the course of years and decades, that doesn't itself change. They've given up finding that. They've given up finding a controlling self, a self that can control what's going on in life. You see? Given up finding all of the myths, and if you're honest with yourself, you believe that there is a self like that inside there somewhere. A unitary self. You're not like Sybil, with the 107 different personalities or something like that. When you talk about, here's how you get in touch with it, okay? Say your name to yourself. When you say your name to yourself, who does that refer to exactly? See? Who or what does that refer to? And then, it refers to me. It refers to me, and that's a singular. I don't say us. It refers to us in here. All monarchs are excluded, the royal we's. But, so it's unitary, right? And there's some sense that it's not a constantly moment-to-moment changing thing, right? That it's got some kind of continuity. And that we have some kind. Then there's the interesting one, that there's some kind of independent me, which means a me that has a body and mind, but isn't the body and mind. You hear the difference? I have a body. I have a mind. I have a mood. I have a thought. See, who's that I that stands apart from the mind and body and yet possesses them? These are all illusions. This is ignorance. And that ignorance gets us into all kinds of trouble. That's the root kind of ignorance. Then there's other kinds of ignorance too. Maybe I won't go into it. Just let me come back to it tomorrow. So then the next verse. Dependent on the karmic predispositions. Okay, number one is what? Yeah. Number two is the potter thing. The predispositions that ignorance makes for us. Thinking that things exist in impossible ways. Dependent on the karmic predispositions, consciousness enters that new birth. Consciousness. Vijnana in Sanskrit. Vijnana. And here it's not consciousness of something. So this is a little bit tricky. As some of you know, consciousness is one of the five skandhas, which we'll talk about in a second. It's five parts of the person. That's always in the plural. The heaps or skandhas are always in the plural. So there's six consciousnesses, actually. There's the visual consciousness of what you are aware of seeing. Audio consciousness, tactile consciousness, smelly consciousness, olfactory consciousness, tasty consciousness. And then the consciousness of what I'm thinking or feeling. Consciousness of something. Here it seems to mean the ability to be conscious. Sometimes they say the mind stream. Consciousness enters that new birth. So having sprung from ignorance with karmic predispositions, then consciousness arises. The consciousness in the sense of the ability to be conscious. You see what I mean? The ability to be conscious. So as I think I mentioned in the... Oh, maybe not. Sometimes people, Buddhas, say, so consciousness is what transmigrates. Consciousness is what goes from one lifetime to another. And that's fine as far as it goes. But consciousness is not a thing. Consciousness is a process. Only. Consciousness is an activity. And then they say, well, mind stream. I got a stream. I said, mind and stream. And then I really got something. I got like a soul called a mind stream. I won't call it a soul because I'm a Buddhist. But I just call it mind stream as if that kind of gets me off the hook. Not talking about anything here. Not talking about an entity. that it's reborn. We're talking about flow and the direction of flow. So the direction of flow is conducted by the propensities, by the karmic propensities. Number two, the potter. And that potter then creates the energy. You see, the karmic predispositions, the karmic imprints, create the direction in which the flow occurs, the energy. Due to ignorance, we create karma, here in the sense of predispositions or propensities. I already talked about that, sanskaras, right? Towards further ignorant actions. This is what is sometimes called immature or unripened karma. So number two, the sanskaras, is karma in its potential. Karma in its potential, not ripened karma. Karma in potential only. Karmic predispositions leave their imprints or potencies on the consciousness. The continuum that carries these karmic tendencies, is a continuum a thing or a process? You know, as soon as we get words, you know, then we start grasping onto them as if they were things. He's just talking about flow. Just flow. Like a river. There's probably a river around here somewhere that isn't dried out. Is a river a thing or a process? Flowing stream? Yeah, it's just a process. But then we say, no, it's the Colorado River. And then we think that we've got something, finally. Mind stream. I got a mind stream. I got consciousness. You know. And then we think that we're going to be reborn. See, if there's rebirth, okay? If there's rebirth, and I don't know that there is. I don't know that there isn't. I don't know that there is. But if there's rebirth, you will not be the one that's reborn. I can say that with some certainty. It's not you that's going to be reborn. If you think it's you that's going to be reborn, you can quickly tell me who you were in your past life. What gender were you? What race were you? What language did you speak? What were your kids' names? Who are you married to? Where'd you live? Right? Nobody's answering. Why is that? Because you weren't you. You're you now. You were a different snowflake. And you'll, if there is rebirth, you'll be a different snowflake than the snowflake that you are now. You see? But the process, the energy, if there is rebirth, the energy continues, but not in the particulars, not in the individuality. You're going to... Just in the kind of general flow, the general kind of, you know, directionality of the flow, that's all. So, that, you know, this is another kind of grasping to self, is to say, I will be reborn, you know. Oh, boy, glad. I won't go into extinction, you see. You won't just, like, fade out like Porky Pig at the end of the cartoons, you know. That's all, folks, into blackness. But it will be kind of like that, actually. You will not be you. The end of you is coming. You're doomed. Your snowflake is melting. And it won't just like kind of revive like some cartoon character that pops up again. Hi, I'm here back. I'm back. See? So, I mean, this is reality. This is just reality. And it's very important to get that clear so that you stop wasting time. So that you stop thinking, well, all you know, and there's all kinds of ways to procrastinate, including a spiritual one, an Eastern spiritual one, of procrastinating because I've got like so many times to do it, rebirth and all, you know, and then all you know, and among the other kinds of myths of rebirth, in addition to you being you mythically, again, you'll be better next time. You're always going up. It's kind of like the evolutionary theory brought into rebirth, evolutionary progress or something, you know. And nobody has ever taught rebirth like that in the Eastern traditions. Nobody has ever said that you're guaranteed improvement, you know, in a future life. Our karma is very varied. Very varied? You know, we've got all kinds of karma going on. All kinds of, and any one of them could pop up. Any one of those predispositions, propensities could pop up, and there you go. There you are, a worm. you know, or whatever. So, you know, we have to be a little more sophisticated about the understanding of karma and rebirth. It's not you that's going to be reborn. That you can, that I can say with some certainty. I don't know if there's rebirth at all. But if there is, you say your name to yourself will not continue. You know, your energy maybe, but that's not you, that's not who you think you are. You know, the you that you're grasping to, the individual self, the independent self, the unchanging self, the mastermind self that controls everything all the time, that won't continue at all because it was never there. It's just an illusion. It's just a thought. It's just imagine, just your imagination. See? So how could it continue? Because it's not even there. All right, let's finish up, shall we? You guys getting tired or what? The consciousness, the continuum that carries these karmic tendencies into the future where they will ripen as positive or negative experiences. The third link, what's the third link? Consciousness is divisible into causal consciousness and resultant consciousness. Causal consciousness refers to the consciousness at the time the karmic seed has been planted. The consciousness at the time that you did, said, or thought something. And resultant consciousness, which is the consciousness conditioned by previous created karma at the time of conception into a new rebirth. So here it seems like the unfolding is the consciousness that enters that new rebirth. So this would be resultant consciousness. But of course, there has to be consciousness for there to have been a karmic propensity created by ignorance. Right? That doesn't just happen on its own. There has to be awareness. There has to be some kind of awareness of what you said, did, or thought ignorantly that left an imprint. So that's the consciousness, the causal consciousness, and then the resultant consciousness. Together with ignorance and karma, causal consciousness forms the projecting causes for the new birth. Projecting causes, it projects you into another birth. Resultant consciousness, the first of the projected effects of karma, is the consciousness that arises when connection to the new rebirth is made at the moment just after conception. So this is very late and kind of difficult, isn't it?
Yeah.
So don't worry your sweet little heads too much about it. We'll come back to it tomorrow when we're a little fresher. But the main thing is the next part. Name and when consciousness has entered, name and form are instilled. Name and form. Nama rupa in Sanskrit. And that's a kind of a literal translation of nama rupa, name and form. What it means is the four mental parts of a person and the one physical part. Form is the physical part. That's your body. It means your body. And then there are four, according to the scheme in Buddhism, four main parts of the mental part of you. There is consciousnesses, which I mentioned before, right? Consciousnesses. There is the ability to discriminate, to say, this object is different from this object. This smell is different from that smell. This sound is different from that sound. This taste is different from that taste. And this feeling, this touch, this tactile feeling is different from that other one. Okay? Discrimination. And this thought is different from that thought. Okay? Discrimination. Then there's feelings. Feelings. Feelings come in three forms. Positive, negative, and neutral. Okay, but that's the third of the four mental parts of you. Consciousness, discrimination, feelings. And then the fourth one is also called samskara. And these are, this is translated in very different kinds of ways. Predispositions, mental dispositions, volitional formations. Here's one I like. Conscious or unconscious manifestations of will. Conscious or unconscious manifestations of will. So those are the four parts of the thought part of you, the mental part of you. And then there's the body. So we'll end tonight with an exercise that you can do between now and our next class. I think you all got the exercises, did you? I think I got them too. These courses, these middleway courses, all have an exercise attached to each of the class, to each class. Ideally, you would do this over the course of the next week. So actually, you probably only have between now and whenever I teach again, which is the afternoon, I think, sometime. But then you... Okay, good. And then you can take it home. You could have a four-week retreat. And you could do this exercise over the course of the week that begins on Sunday, Sunday night, and do it for a week. For the next week, spend at least 15 minutes each day reviewing the first four links of the chain. Concentrate on the ways you identify with your body, form, and your mind, name. Think about the different and alternating ways you sometimes believe you are your body. And so I gave a couple of examples here. I am 60 years old. What does that mean if you're not identifying with your body? I am 6 foot tall. I am so many pounds. I weigh so many pounds. I am. See, that's identification with the body. Are you your body? Is that who you are? See, is that the Waldo you're trying to find when you're trying to find you? Is the body? I mean, if you were just your body, if you were your body, then you wouldn't need a mind, among other things, because you're your body. I am my body. See? But then we said, no, sometimes I don't want to be my body. I want to be my mind. So then think, sometimes you identify with your mind in its functions. I am smart, dumb, clever, or dim. I am smart. I am sad, happy, angry, jealous. So that's identifying with the parts of the mind, the functions of the mind. I am my feelings. And we do that, don't we? So this exercise is to get you in touch with the fact that we are quite adept at re-identifying ourselves when, you know, at will. You know, kind of like wherever we want to. Sometimes we can be our bodies. I am, 60 years old. Sometimes we can be our feelings. This is a self that's in crisis because it knows it's not there. It's having a perpetual identity crisis. So it looks for anything to identify with. No consistency, no logic, no necessity for any of that. We identify with our roles. I am, a father. I am a son. I am a brother. I am this. I am that. We identify with our professions. I am a dancer. I am a yoga teacher. I am a professor. We identify with all kinds of things. We identify with our nation. I am an American. All of these attempts to be somebody. And we do it with our own heaps, what they call the heaps. Sometimes I say I'm my body. Sometimes I say I'm my mind. Sometimes I say I'm different parts of my mind. I am my memories, sometimes we say. I am a victim of childhood abuse. See, that's identifying with a memory. The self is so desperate to be somebody, it will identify even with the mental afflictions, even with its trauma, even with the most painful parts of ourselves, in order to be somebody. So just take a look at that. At the end of each 15-minute session, so you probably won't have much more than 15-minute sessions between now and tomorrow afternoon, but do it at least once, okay? At the end of this 15-minute session, contemplate on the fact that who we are really is a name in a different sense. Just a name we place over the variety of ever-changing physical and mental parts due to our karmic propensities. Just like we overlay glasses on the parts, the ever-changing parts of this object, we do exactly the same with ourselves. On the basis of a constantly changing and multiple set of physical and mental parts, we say me. That's me. And so you can say, yes, that is the only self that there is, actually. The only self that there is just a name. It's just an idea. just a concept of the self, not something, but just an idea. And you shouldn't look so glum about that, because you can change your idea of yourself, and that means changing yourself. If we had the kind of self that we think we have, how could we ever change it? For one thing, it would be unchanging self, so that would be hard to change. Independently existing, you know, unified, all of these kinds of mythical selves that we think we have. But there is a self that we have, and that's an idea of the self, based on physical and mental parts that are constantly changing and multiple. Okay? Then the last one. Finally, every day, make a list of new karmic imprints, propensities. Though you could be your own potter. You could begin creating that would improve your self-conception or self-image. If there's only a self-conception and not a self, if there's only self-image and not anything other than that as a self, then how can you change your self-image? How can you improve your self-conception? And the answer to that's quite simple, actually. Create better karma. Create better karmic imprints. That means live a better life. Now, you see, in body, speech, and mind. And then you're at the wheel. You're the potter at the wheel, shaping your sense of self. Shaping your future sense of, even your present sense of self. You see, if you try even like, you know, give it a go just this weekend under laboratory conditions here, where everyone's trying to be nice, and for a whole 24 hours, nobody's going to even talk to you. You know, nobody's going to, like, bug you in any way at all, except for maybe how they look. And, see, where, you know, you can actually try to, you know, be a nice person, to try to live a good life, and see if that doesn't make a difference on your sense of self, on your propensities to think the way you do about who you are. And that's how you change you. That's the only way to change you. So first of all, we have to figure out who do we think we are, see, ignorantly. And then, so that's the first part of the exercise, is to go through it and like notice that you think you're a whole lot of different things. Sometimes you think you're your body, sometimes you think you're your feelings, sometimes you think you're your memory, sometimes you think you're all kinds of different things. And so, you know, who the hell are you really? And, you know, and at one level, all you are is an idea. All you are is a concept. So then how could I make a better concept? How could I create a better self-image? And that's about karma. That's about what you do, say, and think. Do, say, and think. And you're making a different kind of impression on you. And that impression, that propensity then comes due in a different kind of consciousness. A different kind of consciousness about your name and form. About your body and mind. So that's good news, okay? That's the real good news. That's self-improvement. That's the only self-improvement there is. Change your sense of self, your concept of self. That's the only self there is to improve. And that's eminently improvable. But you got to create the causes for it. You got to make the right inference. You can't cheat. You can't cheat yourself. Right? You can't pretend to be somebody you're not. Because you're only something. You can't pretend to be something that you're not because you're only pretending to be anybody anyway. All right, that's enough.